Hello and welcome to the UUCSV podcast. I'm Evan Yannick and I'm a member of the Board of Trustees. This is the first week we have publicized the podcast, so I'm hopeful that we have many new listeners. I believe this podcast is going to be a very effective addition to our church communications. The mission of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of the Swannanoa Valley is to create an open, active, and welcoming liberal religious community that nurtures spirituality, inspires growth and learning in the search for truth, and challenges us to live our values conscientiously through service and example. This week, our minister, Michael Carter, gave a sermon focused on the Veterans Day holiday, an important topic to wrestle with as we're still in the midst of the longest war in American history. It was recorded on November 10th, 2019. Please enjoy.
I want to begin with a poem by a gentleman by the name of Wilfred Owen. He wrote a poem called Strange Meeting. Strange Meeting is a poem about reconciliation. Two soldiers meet up in an imagined hell, the first having killed the second one in battle. Their moving dialogue is one of the most poignant in modern war poetry. Wilfred Owen fought and died in World War I. Brother Owen was fatally wounded just a week before the war ended in May 1918. By all accounts, he wanted to return to the front line despite suffering from shell shock, which we call today post-traumatic stress disorder. He wanted to go back because he said that this experience would justify his art. He says, "I know I shall be killed," said he told his brother, "but it's the only place from where I can make my protest from." It's a long poem, but I just picked out chunks of it because it's really long. The majority of the poem is a dialogue between two soldiers set in a dreamlike environment that is, in fact, hell. Enemies in war, the two become reconciled in the end. Strange Meeting is the title taken from a poem by Shelley entitled The Revolt of Islam. I did not get a chance to read that. His poem contains a message of love and forgiveness, and it was written at a time when hate and loathing were at their height, almost like now. When a war on an unimaginable scale took the lives of millions, millions of young men and women. So here we go, Strange Meeting. It seemed that out of battle I escaped down some profound, dull tunnel, long since scooped through granites which titanic wars had groined. Yet also their encumbered sleepers groaned, too fast in thought of death to be bestirred. Then, as I probed them, one sprang up and stared with piteous recognition in fixed eyes, lifting distressful hands as if to bless me, and by his smile I knew that sullen hall. By his dead smile I knew we stood in hell. "Strange friend," I said, "here is no cause to mourn." "None," said that other, "save the undone years and the hopelessness. Whatever hope is yours was my life also." The pity of war. Ah, the pity of war. Now men will go content with what we spoiled, or discontent, boil bloody and be spilled. They will be swift, with swiftness of the tigress. None will break ranks, though nations trek from progress. Courage was mine, and I had mystery. Wisdom was mine, and I had mastery. To miss the march of this retreating world into vain citadels that are not walled. And then, when much blood had clogged their chariot wheels, I would go up and wash them from sweet wells, even with truths that lie too deep for taint. I would have poured my spirit without stint, but not through wounds. not on the cessation of war. Foreheads of men have bled where no wounds were. I am the enemy you killed, my friend. I knew you in this dark, for so you frowned yesterday through me as you jabbed and killed me. I parried, but my hands were loath and cold. Let us sleep now. I've heard it said that God created war so that Americans would learn geography. Our emperor has been quoted as saying that sometimes by losing a battle, you find a new way to win the war, and I am not a graduate of West Point, so I say perhaps. But what we do know that once the first shot is fired, the first two casualties are usually truth and innocence. Omar Khayyam writes in the Rubaiyat, "The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. Nor all the piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel not even half a line, nor all thy tears wash out a word of it." And so it is when we cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. We have the most expensive and lethal military force in the world, but we face no existential threat. Nonetheless, liberals and conservatives alike declare the defense budget sacred. It is difficult for me, now I want to, you know, I don't want to hear it at the line, this is my opinion, but it is difficult for me to personally believe that at this moment ISIS, an organization that could not fill an NFL football stadium on a Sunday afternoon, is the threat that our government and media makes it out to be. Now that can change, but I'm not buying it for now. We live in a nation where we can read your license plate from a satellite, and yet we can't handle these brothers. I do know that a nation that spends more money on war than social uplift must always have an enemy in order to justify its spending. That I know. You don't have to go to West Point to figure that out. Dr. King reminded us in the 60s that a nation that continues to spend more money on military defense than social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And for those of you who say, Michael, you're preaching to the choir, I say not, because if you are at war within yourself individually, which most of us are on some level, then we will project that out. So I'm not speaking to the already converted, not unless you are a saint or a sage. And I thank you for blessing us this morning with your presence. Nevertheless, we barricade ourselves behind a missile defense system. We fight wars that have no vital national security interest and post hundreds of thousands of legions overseas, our men and women. We ask our talented young men and women to die, as we are the only nation on the planet that deploys its military primarily to support foreign policy rather than diplomacy, rather than to defend its borders and its people. U.S. corporations dominate the sale of military hardware. We rely on our military to pursue foreign policy objectives, not diplomacy. President Bush the Younger legitimized the doctrine of preemptive attack and the now permanent war on terror. But how does one make war on an idea? I don't know. Yet both the Bush and Obama administrations made sure that military figures dominate national security positions. President Eisenhower is best known for leading the Allied invasion of Normandy in 1944 during World War II. However, in his farewell address to the nation in January 1961, he warned us about the military-industrial complex. President Eisenhower warned about the dangers of an overgrown and bloated military. President Eisenhower was no great lover of people of color, but that does not make him not wise. Our military is not as bloated as it used to be is now, thanks to Donald Rumsfeld. Remember him? Our armed forces have a leaner and hungrier look. We call them special forces. Green Berets, Navy SEALs, and Delta Forces are the result of a new American military. And because we live in celebrity culture, there's even a TV series called Navy SEALs. There was a time when they were supposed to be top secret, but Hollywood. They are the rock stars of the American military machine. President Eisenhower understood the need for limited, rational engagement to advance the nation's standing, and he was extremely concerned about the consequences of a militarized nation, which is exactly what the United States has become. And he understood the dangers of an alliance between the military and the nation's defense contractors. In a wonderfully written book entitled National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, Melvin Goodman writes, President Eisenhower's legacy for U.S. national security is a complex one. Eisenhower realized that the danger of permanent war would lead to restrictions on civil liberties at home. King talked about this as well. Eisenhower was particularly skeptical of what he labeled brush fire wars and said the U.S. should avoid little wars at great distances from the United States because it could lead to greater confrontations. Vietnam, Iraq, now Africa, Afghanistan, possibly Iran would be excellent examples of brushfire wars. Goodman goes on to write that although Ike's farewell address is famous for its foreign policy insights, he also warned that permanent war and a permanent arms industry would do great harm to American rights and civil liberties. You know, and it's interesting because now that we glorify the military, and if, you know, it's hard to say I'm against war or I'm against, because people, oh my God, you're not patriotic. You're a traitor. There's no either or. Well, of course there is. You just have the courage, the you know what, and the ovaries to do it anyway. But to be against war doesn't mean that you are against the people who go. And you don't want to fall into that. And it takes a lot of courage because you are lambasted that you're just liberal, which is not such a bad word. Fifty-odd years later, our nation is trying to rationalize its use of secret courts, warrants, secret searches of individuals who have not yet been identified as terrorists, and warrantless eavesdropping in violation of the Constitution. President Obama, who has taught constitutional law for decades, never did reverse the transgressions of the Bush, the younger administration. He never did. President Eisenhower would have been shocked at these domestic restrictions, let alone the war crimes and the torture. There's a seat up here, sir. Goodman continues with the statement that 50 or so years ago, Eisenhower expressed concern about the ability of the president to control the military. And since his presidency, most presidents have lacked military experience. As a consequence, these presidents have been deferential to the military and have used military force to bolster their credentials. In the key draft of his farewell speech for January 1961, the key drafter of the speech, Ralph E. Williams, relied on the guidance of a professor of poli-sci, of political science, from Johns Hopkins University, a brother by the name of Malcolm Moose. One of the drafts of that speech referred to the military-industrial congressional complex, with Eisenhower inserting the reference to Congress. Yet when the address was given, the reference to Congress did not appear. Ike asked that it be taken out. He said, and I quote, "It was more than enough to take on the military and private industry. I can't take on Congress as well." Perhaps he should have told that to Kennedy. In fact, according to Goodman, an entire speech was taken out, An entire section was taken out of the speech, dealing with the president's concerns about the creation of a permanent war-based industry. And here we are today. To my mind, America, though thin in the guise of democracy, you have to remember, democracy is an experiment. We have not achieved it yet. This was an experiment. We've become an empire because of our vast military involvement in multinational corporations. And those of us who hold God and country as a theology identify the United States as especially chosen by a God to fight the forces of evil in the world. They miss the many ways the U.S. operates in the interest of elite power brokers. Rome also publicized itself as a savior of the world. And here we are. The White House and the Pentagon, needing to justify large defense expenditures, turn to regional conflict as the new geopolitical challenge. So now insignificant states have become the threat to the new world order. Any hostile power must not be allowed to dominate a region critical to our interests, which just happens to be the entire planet. This is the new prescription for the Pax Americana. I dislike war, but I do not dislike soldiers. I believe engaging in armed combat goes against the teachings of all religions, at least theoretically. I'm not naive, and I know that some wars must be fought. And I respect the fact that war veterans have made incredible sacrifices for causes they believed at the time to be noble. I am generally in favor of cutting military spending, but I think we should increase spending on medical and psychological care for veterans. The high rate of mental illness, divorce, and suicide among military veterans causes me deep sorrow and much concern. To quote Brother Bernie Sanders, if you don't want to take care of them when they come home, then don't send them in the first place. That's a quote, not an endorsement. A parent once told me about their first grader coming home from school one day some years ago with a little newspaper that featured an Iraq war veteran who had lost his leg. She told me he was a hero because he killed the bad guys. I asked her, "How do you know who the bad guys are?" She never answered. There are three sides to every story, yours, mine, and the truth. Memorial Day and Veterans Day dredge up the same feelings in me. Many of us have children. What kind of world will we leave them? Listen to the wisdom of Albert Einstein. I don't know what weapons World War III will be fought with, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. The nuclear clock is closer now to midnight than ever before in human history. Those who love peace must learn to organize as effectively as those who love war. So the question becomes, and I don't have an answer, not for you, I have an answer for me, is there a way on this day, and we'll be talking about it again in May for Memorial Day, for us to honor the spirit of sacrifice, but not the acts of destruction? Is there a way to give thanks for the selfless nature of our veterans without condoning the violence that they have to commit? I have friends who fought in Vietnam, and they will never get over some of the things that they did there and saw. Is there a way to advocate for better treatment of soldiers without supporting the work of the military, industrial, entertainment, prison, congressional complex? I believe the best way to honor all veterans is to make sure that there are as few new veterans as possible. The Dalai Lama has this to say about war. He says, most of us have been conditioned. Since armies are legal, we feel that war is acceptable. In general, nobody feels that war is a criminal act or that accepting it is a criminal act. But we've all been brainwashed. War is monstrous. Its very nature is one of tragedy and suffering. Listen once again to the words of Dr. King. Mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind. President Jimmy Carter said that war may be a necessary evil, but no matter how necessary, it is always an evil. It's never good. We can do better, and we must do better. The very future of our species and the planet are at stake, and so maybe we can learn the mistakes of the past, or otherwise there will be no future for us. Einstein was once again quoted as saying that you cannot solve a problem from the same consciousness that created it in the first place. I think they call that insanity, right? Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. At the end of his book, Melvin Goodwin writes, "The misuse of U.S. military power in Iraq and Afghanistan over the past decade has ensured violence and chaos in these regions for years to come." You know, we've pulled out of Iraq. It is a mess. We did the same thing in Vietnam. We go in and we meddle and we leave. And then look at this, right? It's you know, it's called karmic. It's cause and effect. The bombs we dropped there, you will feel them back here. Believe me, in some kind of way we will. The age of the superpower is over. It's done. And all we have to do is just manage how costly the funeral will be. Winston Churchill once said that jaw is better than war. Another flawed human being, but he had some insights. You see, peace is not the goal. The goal is not to have peace. Peace is the tool that we use to achieve our goals. Peace is low-hanging fruit. We can't even reach it. But that's not the goal. That's the tool. In 1955, philosopher Bertrand Russell and Albert Einstein issued a statement that is even more prophetic for our times now. They said that we have to learn to think in a new way. We have to learn to ask ourselves, not what steps can be taken to give military victory to whatever group we prefer, but there are no longer such steps. The question is, we have to ask ourselves is, what steps can be taken to prevent a military contest that will be disastrous to all parties? I mean, just think of it. Perhaps, only perhaps, there may be problems that armies cannot solve. You ever thought about that? Suppose they gave a war and nobody showed up. Plato reminds us that only the dead have seen the end of war. But I remind you this morning that war is obsolete. It's just so uncivilized. King tells us that war is a poor chisel to carve out a peaceful tomorrow. We have guided missiles and misguided generals. Perhaps it's time to learn how and when to stand down. Can we do this as a culture? In Shakespeare's Henry V, Henry says, "All things are ready, if our minds be so." His lieutenant, Westmoreland, interesting name, his response is, "Perish the man whose mind is backwards now." This is before they make their charge. Unless our minds move forward from antiquated thoughts of war and violence, we will all die a very horrible death. And so once again, we come back to the age-old adage that has been passed down to us from saints and avatars and sages and prophets alike over millennia. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. May the love which overcomes all differences, which heals all wounds, and which puts to flight all of our fears. You have no more fear now when you leave here. Voila, it's gone. Which reconciles all of us who are separated. May that love, may that lack of fear be with us all. I would say until we meet again, but forever. Bon appetit. Bon appetit.
Thanks for listening to this powerful message. Please come back next week when we'll hear Reverend Carter's message about religion becoming politics by other means.